Okay, I'm ready to field any question as long as I don't know is a good answer.
Actually, I have three questions, but...
Okay, why don't you do one and then I'll try and answer it.
The first one refers to what you were talking about this morning, the origin of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this down to try to keep from getting confused, which is why I didn't. It says, the origin of life is described in terms of a proper arrangement of particles or those numbers. And, of course, it was found that it was forbiddingly impossible, you know, improbable that that would ever happen randomly. Question is, though, but if God is living and if God created all matter, then shouldn't we conclude that the arrangement of matter is irrelevant to the existence of life?
Okay. I don't think we know for sure whether it's possible by arranging matter properly to get life out of it. But that's what the guys who are looking for origin of life theories, and that's what the artificial life guys are assuming, okay? And so basically, for the sake of argument, I grant that to them and say, what can we say then, okay? So that's basically the direction I went. I don't know for sure whether that's satisfactory. I am pretty well satisfied that if you build more and more complicated things, you won't suddenly get consciousness or something of that sort. So I have a pretty strong gut feeling in that direction, but I don't know for sure whether if you knew how to put all the chemistry together, you might not get life. So I just kind of leave that as an open question, and we're going at it from that direction. And I don't know for sure that the Bible tells us in any way on that. It's clear that God made the life that exists, but he made man as in his own image, humans in his own image, and so we can obviously mimic some things he's done. And whether this is one of the things or not, I don't know. The nearest thing to it that I can think of in Scripture is the remark about the, I think it is the second person of the, what we might call the satanic, no, it's the third person of the satanic trinity, if you like, in Revelation, who makes an image and, how does it do, causes it to live? Let's see if I can find that passage. It's in Revelation 12, I think, or 13. It's in 13. The beast out of the earth. I saw another beast coming out of the earth, two horns like a dragon, etc. Performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven. He was given, he ordered them to set up an image, verse 14. This is Revelation 13, 14. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed, etc. The description there that we get, John's description of what he's seeing in the vision, is a little ambiguous on whether we're to understand he really brings this thing to life or whether he fakes it in some way or another. And so it could go either way, I think. That's about the only passage I can think of that might have any bearing on is it possible for created beings to make something living or something of that sort.
So really the answer is it depends on the definition of life, you know, it's consciousness, which I would define as conscious.
Okay, well, we're thinking of intelligent life as probably consciousness,
right.
And I'm very skeptical that that is merely a complicated enough arrangement of atoms.
I don't see how it could, because otherwise when we die, the arrangement is going to decompose.
Certainly the Bible is very clear that there's some kind of a dualism, although you get some theologians arguing about that. There's some kind of a dualism in which humans survive death. And again, we don't know the mechanisms, but that's how we use the spirit or the soul-spirit distinction over against the body. There's a Canadian brain researcher whose name is very well known but never comes to my mind when I need it, who said that his view of the matter was that the brain is a type of machine that a spirit can operate. And so he was kind of looking in that direction, thinking about what's going on. So I think we're a little stuck on the definition of life. It might be that it's something that if you know how to put the right stuff together, you got it, or it might not. And of course, Darwinism has been very strongly against vitalism, that there's something more there, but they've made their case. And on that particular point, at least, I'm not ready to argue with them in the sense that I know that they're wrong on that particular matter. So I don't know whether they're wrong. Yeah. Okay, that was question one, I guess. Okay.
The other two questions are more from last night. And you were saying that the space was like a balloon, and then the stars were like
dots on the polka balloon. Dots on the balloon.
And
okay.
When it blew up. Okay, my question is then, if space itself expands like a balloon carrying the stars farther apart, then what is space? And how is it distinguished from non-space?
One of the embarrassing things about physics is that virtually all of the basic concepts are undefined.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
So, now, what is matter? Philosophers have a definition of matter. It has to do with extension and things of that sort. But physicists generally stayed away from that. And so there's some that think that matter is basically some kind of energy or something, because it obviously is convertible into energies of one sort or another. What is space? What is time? I'm not sure. Obviously, a lot of cosmologists believe that space and time came into existence at the Big Bang. Ross goes in that direction as well. Hugh Ross goes in that direction as well. I've had a little bit of reluctance in that direction. Our space and time apparently comes into existence at the Big Bang. But the Bible, it seems to me, pictures God as experiencing time in some kind of sense. In thinking through kind of the two standard positions in Christian theology on that, which as far as I know have no denominational connections or anything. One of them is kind of that God is outside time, and the other is that God inhabits time. That time is somehow a part of him in the way that logic is a part of God, etc. That God's not above logic or below logic. It's internal to him, and some kind of way of experiencing things sequentially is there. It's not hard at all to find theologians who believe that God is kind of outside, above, or something of that sort, time. The theologians I can think of, or philosophers I can think of, who feel that God is in time, one would be this J. Oliver Buswell I mentioned this morning. And another would be the philosopher, evangelical philosopher, Nicholas Wolterstorff. And in looking through their stuff, I think they've got the better exegetical case than the guys who picture God as outside time. Neither the New Testament word ion or the Old Testament word olam are words for timelessness. They're both words for an extended or even unbounded period of time. And so God, the passage that's translated God inhabits eternity is actually inhabits the ages as such. So you get some peculiar thing now. Now that's caused me to wander enough from your question. I forgot exactly what it was about. Space from non-space. I'm not sure you can. The way I visualize things, I'm inclined to visualize something like heaven or something like that as a bigger space of more dimensions that our space is embedded in. And so our little universe is going on inside this, and this other space of larger dimension is outside. And I don't mean larger dimension like, the property here is of larger dimensions than this building. So if you go out that door, you'll still be on the property. But you're actually going in some other direction or something. That is really hard to visualize. But I better leave it that way. There are a number of passages in Scripture that seem to suggest that the relationship of heaven to us or the unseen world to us is something like another spatial dimension or more spatial dimensions or something of that sort.
So when you say that space really isn't well defined, and when they talk about the Big Bang being the result of a tear in the fabric of space and time, they really don't know what they're talking about.
They might know what they're talking about, but I'm not sure I know what they're talking about.
If they can't communicate it, what value is it?
Yeah, it could be done better, I suppose.
Okay, the third question now is from last night as well. It's a little harder to define, but I think it's relative to the situation. When mass is converted to radiation, as in a nuclear detonation, the most that it can accelerate is to c, the speed of light. That being the case, how come then Einstein's theory, when that is converted, how come you get c squared? Where does the square?
Well, that gives it the right units. If you remember from your high school physics or whatever physics you ever had, kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared. And so to get units of energy out of you've got a mass and a velocity squared. That's how you have to get the thing there. Energy is defined in kind of the simplest terms as ability to do work or something of that sort. Neither of them are rates, are they? I think they're the same units. Boy, it's been a long time since I thought about this. So units of work are I'm not going to get into joules. It's been too long for that. I'm going to stay over with looking at the quantities. a unit of work is force times a distance, okay? Force can be converted into F equals MA, so a mass times an acceleration. So a mass times an acceleration times a distance gives you two T's on the bottom and two positions on the top, and that gives you two V's, so you get V squared. So yeah, the units are MV squared, so that's how you get MC squared. Now, that's a rest energy of some sort. So when you're talking about the energy of a moving particle, it would have this rest part, MC squared, plus a motion part, which is half MV squared. And don't ask me what happens as you, whether that gets fretted up some as you get near the speed of light. I don't remember that. So, been too long since I'm away from physics. Okay, we better get out of this and get some less technical questions here.
I guess I have a bit of a theological question for you, Bob. Suppose evolution were true.
All right.
So just suppose for the moment that somebody came up with enough evidence that we were all thoroughly convinced macroevolution actually works.
Well, they'll never come up with enough evidence that we'd all be convinced. Well, okay. I mean, if people believe the Earth is flat, okay, but...
What do you think is the least problematic, I guess is the way to put it, probably, of all of the theistic evolutionary theories in terms of fitting with the Bible? So I guess what I'm getting at is sort of what do you see as being absolutely essential to read into the Old Testament description of the creation of man?
Yeah.
Specifically man, not so much the animals.
Yeah. Absolutely essential is kind of a tricky word, but it seems to me that the model which some even evangelicals hold, and certainly many, many more liberalizing persons who call themselves Christians hold, that a whole population of apes gradually developed into humans seems to me to run an awfully serious problem with the Genesis account regarding the creation of man. Because the Genesis creation account seems to picture a situation in which God takes an individual, makes an individual, and then gives that person life, and then makes another individual from him and such. And so it sounds like there's an original human, or an original pair, and then some rather central features of biblical theology regarding the creation of humans as upright, but their rebellion and fall into sin seem to me to come from that. And yet, at least several of the writers who have written articles in the American Scientific Affiliations Journal, which is a journal for the ASA, which is a certainly conservative a group of Christians who are in the sciences. I mean, they do believe the basic doctrines of Christianity. I think that's pushing it some. A position that's probably more common among evangelicals who are theistic evolutionists is that God took an existing ape or anthropoid that was moved over a good ways from the ape and remodeled him. Okay, and they then generally take, they breathe into him, etc. God put a human soul in this being, and he then becomes a human, and then makes Eve out of him. At least on that, you see, you do have an original human, you have an original pair, and you do then have a real fall into sin. Whereas if you have this whole population moving over here, what's the account of the fall about? And the people who go with that whole population moving over, they basically say it's a parable of some sort. I have some problems with that. So to me, I have some questions regarding the orthodoxy of someone who holds that, though there are people in good standing in the ASA who hold that particular thing. There's nothing in the doctrinal statement of the ASA that would forbid such people to be there. So I would say if I had to move to a theistic evolutionary position, I would move, I think, to that one with a what we might call an Adam type. The terms I use for them, but I know of no one else that uses these terms, is a Adam type theistic evolution and a no Adam type theistic evolution. That's ADAM, not ATOM. Yeah, I think that's pretty central. Because if you get this whole development moving over here, then you ask, when does doing certain things become sin? And surely if you've got this kind of gradual movement, you've probably got a gradual awakening of that sort of thing. It's like the spectrum going from red to orange. You know, when does it change from red to orange? Well, there's no place to draw a line. It's just gradually, etc. And was there then any original fall? And so to import Darwinism in that variety, and notice that's still considerably more orthodox than some kind of Darwinism which there's no God out there. But to import that, I think, does move you over in a direction that seems to me to undercut what the Bible, I think, suggests is the human's major problem, rebellion against God, and some kind of hint of how it got started.
A quick follow-on to that, and then I'll pass the mic on before I ask any others. When Cain slew Abel, and he was sent out, all of a sudden there are all of these other people in the land. Where did they come from?
Okay, well, we certainly don't know that all of a sudden there were all these other people. In fact, we can be quite sure they weren't all of a sudden.
I guess what I'm getting at is that it seems
to me... Where'd they come from? Where'd Cain get his wife? That's what you're...
Yeah, well, it seems to me, too, that when people take the genealogies
to
try and date anything, you have a problem there simply because there's no mention of any other children of Adam and Eve, but all of a sudden, you know, Cain is out there, and now all of a sudden we're talking about all these other people. Yeah. It doesn't imply that there's no passage of time, but there's no indication of how they got there.
Well, in fact, there is a... In the genealogies, there is a reference to other sons and daughters of Adam and Eve. Yeah. It's just that genealogy is mentioned later than that point in the account. Okay, so there's a tendency... of reading something that hadn't been mentioned yet, hadn't happened. That's probably a natural tendency for us when we read things, but it's wrong about half the time, okay? That a writer will often concentrate on one thing and not mention that some other things have happened that might be significant. And you've really only got two choices at that point. Either Adam and Eve are the first of whatever this group is, but there's a whole other group of what you'd have to say is humans, okay? Mate with each other anyway. You either got that, or you've got that Cain's wife is actually one of the sisters. We have information that Adam and Eve lived hundreds of years. And we don't know when this Cain and Abel thing took place. Obviously, if there's anything to the biblical account, aging is operating differently at that point. And so they might have themselves been hundreds of years old by this point. So, don't know. It's a problem, but I would certainly opt for one of Cain's sisters.
In the context of evolution, I know in some of my classes we've talked about the endosymbiotic theory, and I'm not sure if you're aware. I think
what you're talking about is how you get mitochondria how you go from prokaryotic to eukaryotic cells by sticking some other one-celled organisms inside, and then you get a more complicated single-cell thing. Is that what you're thinking about?
And then also the existence of a separate genetic code in mitochondria. I was wondering. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the mitochondria have set their own DNA and such.
Yeah, I was wondering how non-evolutionists would attempt to refute the...
I don't know that there's any need to refute it. A person who believes that God made everything zap like that in a few thousand years ago would just say he made it that way. And yes, because it's got multiple parts, you can say, well, although that part looks like it might have been something that's independent, it wasn't really independent. An old Earth creationist is somewhat up in the air on the question of how many things did God create by, shall we say, from scratch, and how many things did he create by some kind of intervention of one sort or another. And he might have, done something to... the structure of existing cells, prokaryotic cells, to now make them be eukaryotic cells. But one of the things he might have done is invite a host in and modify it so it could function inside. So I don't know that we need to rule that particular kind of case out of court. That may be some remnant of how it was done. And yet it probably, I think it would still suggest that's more likely to work properly if you have somebody overseeing that than it is if that happens. If that happens randomly, most of the stuff we get inside of us doesn't seem to be helping us out in that sense, but seems to be taking over our machinery and messing up our cells or something of that sort. Better leave it at that.
This question is a little bit of explanation. Is we see in the scripture. Most of the time, things happening in the usual, what we say, naturalistic way. But at times, we see things like Joshua, where the sun sits still. We see the sun going back 10 steps on the steps of Ahaz. We see the Red Sea opening.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
We see God acting at certain times beyond naturalistic explanation. And I know certainly evolutionists have accused creationists of when you can't explain something, say God did it. But
uh-huh.
at some point, it seems, especially to me, like they say the idea of the universal flood. Well, you can't come up with enough water to do it, or the thing where the light come from before the stars. We see God acting at some point beyond what we can even understand, and
uh-huh.
it seems like if we get caught up too much in giving having to give a naturalistic explanation to everything, that we are also limiting God's ability to do things. When He says He covered the earth with water, what are we going to do?
I agree with you. I've pointed out on a number of occasions that it would not be unreasonable at all to suggest that they have a worldwide flood. God brings in from somewhere or creates out of nothing three times as much water as we've currently got, floods the place with it, and takes it back. And one could understand that the phrase windows of heaven might very well point to something like that. Just doesn't say where it goes when it leaves, okay, but might suggest that particular sort of matter. So basically what I would suggest there is persons who believe that there's a God who can intervene in the universe have to realize He can choose to do so when He wants to, and you try and see whether there's warrant for thinking it's a special intervention versus providential oversight in particular cases. I have a friend who feels that God is rather economical, and so He doesn't intervene unless He feels He needs to or something of that sort. Doesn't waste interventions or something. That's interesting, but I'm not sure what to do with that. There are a lot of things like that where you can kind of invent a rule that helps you in your decisions on making deciding what didn't happen. But the trouble is the universe going to back you up? And answer, don't know. So our students at seminary take a course in hermeneutics, rules of biblical interpretation, and I always point out that I'm somewhat skeptical of this sort of stuff because you really want to study the scripture for yourself and then kind of try and figure out as you're working with it what rules for interpretation are being used by the writers and actors who are approved in the thing and such. And you don't want to be pulling bunnies out of hats, but on the other hand, you don't want to be ignoring stuff that's really there because your rules don't allow it. A nice example in the history of New Testament interpretation was a rule devised by a fellow named Adolf Ulliker late in the last century. He said, Jesus' parables only make one point. And believe it or not, lots of evangelicals have tended to follow Him in that direction. He was unhappy about allegorizing tendencies in the interpretation of Jesus' parables. The only trouble is, Jesus' parables come during a time period when you have rabbinic parables around, and some rabbinic parables make one point, and some make more than one point. And another trouble, it wasn't the only trouble, another trouble is that the interpretation of Jesus' parables given in the scriptures sometimes make more than one point. And Ulliker's move there, which was picked up by Rudolf Bultmann, was to say, well, the interpretations aren't authentic. Interpretations are by some writer further on. He didn't know what Jesus was talking about. Well, he's more likely to have known what Jesus was talking about than Rudolf Bultmann was. Come back to that. So we do need to be careful about those things. What I do feel, I was just reading a paper this afternoon by a former student here that was in my packet of notes I brought here for my question and answer session, that pointed out that someone like Henry Morris was basically arguing that the scientific evidence is more strongly in favor of a young Earth than it is in favor of an old Earth. And he is committing himself at that point to somebody judging that on the basis of the scientific evidence. And then if he starts bringing in, well, we solved this one by miracle, and we solved that one by miracle, and we solved this one by miracle, I begin to suspect that he's not getting his information from the scientific data. He's getting his information from how he's interpreted the passage. And so that's driving the thing, and he's willing to have as many miracles as needed to make that work. Well, if the Bible is inerrant and he has interpreted it right, that's probably not a bad procedure. But the Bible is inerrant and he's interpreted it wrong, he's just covering up his wrong interpretation by bringing in miracles to rescue it that, in fact, God didn't do. So you come back to that kind of question again. So that's where we are again, that our rules of interpretation, like looking at the data itself, are things that we have to hold somewhat loosely on the basis of looking at things, trying to ask the Lord to guide us, trying to be fair to the thing, trying to be open to the new information we got.
It just leads into that question about, is there something with that they come up with that is stumping you as far as looks like a young Earth? Like, say, like the dust on the moon was supposed to be accumulating with all this time, and it's not?
Yeah. The dust on the moon would have never bothered me because the dust on the moon is actually fairly thick if you define dust a certain way. and that is stuff that has been pulverized but has now been welded back together by the charges being carried from the solar wind, you've actually got probably 10, 20, 30 feet of that almost everywhere on the moon. So there's a lot of it up there. But secondly, the actual numbers they got were based on some assumptions of how fast meteors were falling into the moon that turned out to be rather heavily overestimated. They took the largest number that somebody was suggesting in the 50s and 60s, and once they began to get out of space and put up little foils to let meteors hit them, they found that the number was much, much smaller than that. So you've got a lot of stuff like that circulating in the young Earth camps, of stuff that has been answered, but they don't like the answer, and they don't tell you what that other answer is, and so you have to go look around for it to find out what's going on. Somebody asked me that a similar question to that, were there anything that I saw? And I mentioned this stuff by Robert Gentry on pleiotropic halos was probably the most impressive thing I had seen. The idea that there are little radiation damage in micas that look like it comes from polonium something or another, one of the isotopes of polonium that has a half-life of 3 minutes. And Gentry's view there was that that showed that the universe was created instantaneously, and then within 3 minutes, this polonium decayed and made these little halos. And so that shows you that that the long history of the development of igneous rock and that sort of stuff on the Earth is not true. And I would not be inclined to take that one thing to overcome what seemed to me to be a mass of materials that point in the direction of an old Earth. Though my own proposal on that, which might not be worth anything, is that if you look in the decay scheme of stuff that decays through polonium, through that polonium isotope, you look one step back, the product ahead of it is radon. Radon's a gas, and so it can move around in cracks and stuff and get into an area perhaps rather quickly, and then come up to the dead end of a crack, and it can't go anywhere else, and so it decays and leaves a little bit of a polonium, it decays with the polonium there, and then the polonium decays and produces a little halo there. So I don't know if that'll explain it or not. It does all right for me at my level of knowledge of those things. Okay.
My daughter had one question from last night. She's one that really was stumped to, how fast is this universe expanding?
That's a tricky question. Because it's like a balloon, and because we're measuring what would be sort of the movement of the polka dots apart, a close polka dot is moving away from us much more slowly than a distant polka dot is. You can give a number, the Hubble constant, which I had written down here somewhere, I saw in my notes this afternoon, but I don't remember what it is, 55 plus or minus 3. Yeah. Where did I see that? I'll never find that. Maybe I will. That's expansion universe. It's on page 3. You're not going to like this when I give you the answer anyway. 55 plus or minus 7 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So that means if you're looking at an object that is a megaparsec away from you, well, what's that? A parsec is 3.2 light years, and a mega one is a million of them, isn't it? Kilo, mega, right, mega. Okay, so it's 3.2 million light years away from you. Objects at that distance are moving more or less 55 kilometers per second away from you, and that works out to what, about 35 or 40 miles per second away from you. And if you go twice that far away, then they're moving twice that fast away and such. So you have to go out quite a ways before they would get very near the speed of light, which is, 186,000 miles, and then you convert that into kilometers, and it's 300,000 kilometers per second or something. So you've got to go out a good ways. Yeah, that is not an up-to-date figure either. That's a figure that was up-to-date when I typed this out probably 5 to 10 years ago. But I don't think that's changed drastically. That produces a Big Bang of 17.7 billion years ago. And I got a couple questions down here.
I have a question about origin of life.
Okay.
If human were created a few thousand years ago, like how do we explain the civilization that was dated longer than, per se, like 4,004 years ago, like India, China? They all have written materials or sites that were dated, like 5,000, 6,000, or even 7,000 years ago.
There are not many young Earth creationists who would date creation at 4004 BC anymore. Someone like Whitcomb, is willing to go out to 10,000 or further, and someone like Morris, who is a little more in that direction, still might be willing to back up some. The guys who are actually thinking through that have moved it back some, but they're basically just going to argue that the dates are wrong once you start pressing them too close. And if you go with C, something like 4,000 or 5,000 for the creation, and then you got to move off about 2,000 years in this direction for the flood, you are in fact treading on some dates that we think that our civilization's around. So the fact of the matter is that in young Earth creation position, there is quite a wide variety among the positions inside that particular view. So you have some 4,004 guys, but probably not many of the people who've actually grappled with the other evidence. But you've got other guys out to 20,000 for the origins. And again, then you'll have some movement on when the flood was and such. So there are various ways of trying to solve that particular one. I'm not trying to do any of those because I think we're talking further back. The pure guess I gave last night, I think it was, that the mitochondrial Eve stuff may point back to the period of creation, and the Y chromosome Adam might point back to Noah and his sons, would give you perhaps 50,000 years ago for the flood, and then maybe 100,000 or something of that sort for creation of Adam and Eve. So that may be pushing it some. There are many, many Christians who feel that's putting too much time in the genealogies. Too many gaps in the genealogies, and I sympathize with them, but I don't know what to do about it. So there we are. Yeah. Okay? Further questions? So one up here.
This should be an easy question for simple minds like mine. I think it was Friday night you referenced something to do with post-World War II telescope technology had advanced or something at that point. Could you just comment what was the change in technology, and then maybe related to that too is a radio telescope. What is a radio telescope and how does it work?
Okay. The post-World War II and more recently, I think, is what the actual phrase was about, and I didn't have anything about optical telescopes in my slide on that particular thing, but I stuck it in. Right after World War II, radio telescopes were developed. Good reason for that. Somebody had actually done something we'd call radio telescoping in the 30s, but the military had built all these radar antennas. And so there's all this surplus floating around at the end of World War II. And so a bunch of those began to be used and they began to work on radio receivers. A radio telescope is a very sensitive radio receiver, that is aimed at the sky to see if we get radio signals from out there. And the vast majority of the guys working with them aren't expecting to get intelligent signals from them. But they're expecting to find out what objects out there in the sky radiate, not in the visible, but in the very long wavelengths that we would call microwaves to even regular transmission lengths, which are quite long. Forgotten the wavelengths, and we'll get meter and anyway. So a radio telescope is basically a device to detect those. And even when I was in grad school, which was 30 years ago, you basically had one of those things aimed at the sky. You'd often just have it sitting there and let the stars move by as the Earth rotated, and you would just read the signal as it went. So you were just marking a little path in the sky. You weren't getting an image at all. Now they've sophisticated that so you can actually get some kind of an image. You can measure the stuff that's off axis and make a picture from that sort of thing as well. And so you can actually get pictures of the sky in radio wavelengths and in shorter wavelengths. The 3-degree black body radiation was discovered by that kind of a technique, and certain lines in the hydrogen atom were discovered that way that allow us to map the shape of the galaxy better than we could optically because there's a lot of dust and stuff in the way. So there are a lot of things done that way. That's what I've really meant about since World War II, and that of course has continued to advance as the electronics have gotten better. I think the 200-inch telescope was probably built in the 50s, if my memory serves. There was really only, as far as I know, one attempt to build anything bigger than that. The Russians built something bigger than that. I don't remember the size of it, whether it was just a few inches bigger or whether it was a good bit bigger, but it didn't work very well. They had some trouble getting the mirror to behave properly. And so that seemed to be the thing. You're talking big, heavy mirrors that were very hard to cool from their thing without producing the wrong kind of stresses in them, and then you had to grind the thing and such. And somebody, probably 15, 20 years ago, developed a technique by which you rotate the glass as it's cooling, and you automatically get a little bit of the right kind of a shape for a magnifying mirror, and then you don't have to do near as much grinding. And they figured out a way to put backings on them so that they were much lighter and such. So you had kind of a breakthrough in the technology of mirrors. Since then, they've also figured out ways to make mirrors that you can change the shape of slightly. You might call rubber mirrors or something, not made of rubber, but something like that. And so they're developing techniques to build bigger mirrors. The Keck instrument down here in, where is that, Arizona or something, is one of those, and they're building something in Hawaii. No, it's in Hawaii, isn't it? The Keck one's in Hawaii. They're building something down in South America that's going to be quite big as well. And you're building segmented mirrors where you have a bunch of things that you move around a little bit to get the shape just right. So you're getting a lot of bigger instruments now in the last 10, 15 years than you've ever had before. So that's basically what that was about.
My family and I were talking last night about your the bichromosome atom and the mitochondrial Eve and that atom appearing to be about 50,000 years. Mm-hmm. And just in your opinion, there being a regional flood, it's still reasonable to think that Noah would be the ancestor of all living humans.
It sounds like, from the biblical account, that nobody else escaped the flood. And the way you would work that then for regional is everybody for some reason decided to stay in that region, which would perhaps suggest that there was something especially good about that region. If it was during the ice ages, it might have been a low spot where the temperature was nice. And ice ages, of course, lock up a lot of things. If you think in terms of the Black Sea, there may have been no drainage into the Black Sea from the north because it's all locked up in glaciers. And the glaciers aren't melting. And so here's a low area. The lower you go, typically the temperature goes up. And so if it's not too dry, it can be a helpful place. And so perhaps they had congregated down in that area. It was the nicest climate on Earth. And then the rains begin. And within a week or so of the rains beginning, you can't cross any of the streams. There's no way out of the area. And then the stuff begins to break up and the ice melting and the stuff all comes flowing down there and just fills the basin up. So that's the kind of scenario. Now, we're imagining it, but suggesting that that might be a way of viewing that particular kind of phenomenon.
I'd just like to, ask a little different direction question.
Go ahead.
We hear a lot about man cloning animals these days.
Okay.
And then you read, God makes man in his own image. You know, when I hear people talking about the cloning experiments, I just think we're replicating what God did creating Eve from Adam.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Okay, but then the next step is, you know, to have Adam made in God's image. Does that raise any conjectures in your mind?
Oh, yeah, that raises lots of conjectures in my mind. You want me to talk about cloning first? Or? I've never had any huge opinions on cloning before, hadn't thought that much about it. I mean, I've read some of the stuff. One of our associates in IBRI did a talk on cloning, human cloning, just a month ago or less. So I got to thinking about that. My guess is that it can be done eventually. And once it can be done, somebody's going to be doing it. Hard to get around that. I mean, you say, we'll make a law against it. Come on, how many laws in this world aren't there plenty of people violating? So it's going to happen. I personally think that however God has set up the relationship between soul and spirit, that if we clone humans, they're going to have spirits. But see how that works. I think, however, being human nature being what it is, there are going to be some bad uses arise out of it. And it's not too hard to think of a few possibilities in that direction, particularly if you can figure out some kind of cloning that you can, you know, put them in little incubators of some sort that they don't need mothers, and crank them out, and then you've got a slave class if you want one, or you've got a warrior class if you want one, or you've got a a scientist class if you want one or something of that sort. Or if you don't want any of those, you can make organs to sell for transplants or something of that sort. All those ideas have been broached. So to me, it's an example, I think, of a new technology. Every time new technologies are available, they open up vistas for both good things that can be done and bad things that can be done. And human nature being what it is, both of those get done. And there we are. Now, you had another question on the other end, and I've already forgotten what it was. I can't say six sentences without losing track of what was previous. After the colonial thing, you had something about...
Well, it was looking at the precedent or the original cloning of
okay.
Eve from Adam. And then if you take...
If you ask, what does that mean? One of the things that surely must mean in the context is, in distinction from the animals, we resemble God. There's something about us that we share with God that the animals don't share with God. Now, the animals share life with God. We share life with God. So it's not just life. It's something more than that. So probably one of the ways to work is to think about what distinguishes humans from the animals. And one thing that strikes many people, I think, then is some kind of a moral or spiritual sphere in our existence, that we do seem to have concerns of certain sorts that, as far as we can tell, the animals don't have. Of course, it's a little tricky to tell what animals do and don't have. We can't communicate with them very well. And we can fairly easily ascribe human features to them occasionally. You naughty kitty cat and that sort. And whether that cat is actually naughty or not can be argued, perhaps. So one of the things that is... but typically some things have been done there is then to think... one thing to do is to kind of make a list of what God is like. And then go through the list and see which one of those humans share. So you might take the Westminster Catechism answer to who is God or what is God like. God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable, and his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. And say, man is a spirit incarnated in a body, finite, created, let's put that in place of eternal, finite, created, and changeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. And so then you got some kind of list, and then you try and go through and say, okay, let's take a cat, let's take a dog, let's take a horse, let's take a pig, and see which of those categories apply to them. And you would see some of those things, I think, we would say, don't apply to humans. Now, you might object that the Westminster Catechism isn't the Bible, okay, and it's not, though it's constructed by men who are pious, but that sort of thing. So maybe that's But I think that can give you some ideas in that direction. And one of them would be some kind of a moral sphere, operating within some kind of a moral sphere, I think you would say. A number of people have suggested God is creator, and we are sub-creators in some sense. We're able to create on a lower level. A direction I've gone off with is this. It says we resemble God in some way. Let's see if we can find pictures in the Bible in which God pictures himself as a human. And lo and behold, I found a whole spectrum of such pictures. God is the potter, we're the clay. God is the farmer, we're the plant. God is the shepherd, we're the sheep. God is the master, we're the slave. God is the king, we're the subject. God is the father, we're the children. God is the husband. Whole sequence of things. And so you ask yourself then, when humans are doing these kind of activities, making pottery, growing plants, having pets, watching sheep, run up the whole list, they are imaging God to a certain extent. They may be doing a crummy job of it, or they might be doing a fair job of it, and so you could come at it from that direction and try and unpack that. I'm going to quit at that point.
I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. One is, how long ago was the scientific evidence for the Big Bang being about? Well, how long ago was the Big Bang theory?
How long ago was the theory?
Yeah,
that was invented in the 20s. Okay, what is the? George Lemaître is generally considered the first proponent, and he's in the late 20s, I believe. And things have developed along the line. I mean, it's rather different than what he proposed, but that's about when it was first proposed.
What about the modern timing of it?
The timing of it is kind of just settling down now. We hope it's just settling down now. There's been some argument for maybe 10 years or so that certain ways of measuring the date of the Big Bang and other ways have been pretty divergent. And sometimes by opponents of the Big Bang, it's been characterized as you guys have stars that are older than the universe, et cetera. Anyway. So now that seems to be coming together, and my impression is it's coming together a little under 15 billion years, is the current figure. Better leave it at that number rather than being tricky.
The other question I had is, just a clarification, something that I didn't understand from your talk on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
When you were trying to describe why God wouldn't reveal himself in the hidden in the number of pi, and you talked about logic, you mentioned it again tonight, about logic being uncreated or something like that. Could you just expand? I don't understand.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I understand that, but we'll give it a try. I take mathematics as some kind of a branch of logic. Mathematicians probably take logic as a branch of mathematics. But whatever. I think we are inclined to think that numbers like 1, 2, 3, etc., and their relationships, larger, smaller, the operations, addition, subtraction, etc., are some kind of logical structures, and there's some sense in which a person couldn't just say, "Well, I'm going to decide that 3 + 2 = 4." That you're really kind of restricted. It is one way, and it's not some other way. And the question then would be, did God invent that? Could he change it? Or is that really kind of a part of God's nature? That's really a part of the feature of thought itself. It is somewhat related to the question of whether God invents morality, whether God is above morality, whether God is below morality, etc., or whether morality is a part of the description of what God is like. You get the same thing with love and something of that sort. There are some theists that kind of talk as though, if God says black is white, then black is white or something of that sort. And as I read the Bible, God cannot say that black is white because he cannot lie. And so that's was the kind of thing I was grappling with a little bit there, is that pi is defined a certain way, and once you've defined it, then you can't manipulate what its values are. You're going to get those values. One of our friends here suggested that because the digits in pi are truly random, that if you go out far enough in the digits of pi, you will eventually get a place where you could structure it so that you get a bunch of zeros with the ones that formed a circle, etc. That might be very far out, of course. But if that's so, then that wouldn't prove anything, okay? Sagan was trying to work in the story, at least, with the idea that this was statistically significant. It was way up sooner than you'd expect, or is a bigger pattern than you'd expect, or something of that sort, and such. And I was a little skeptical that that's the way that God would do, even be able to do that, maybe. Those kind of things. We'll leave it at that. So, yeah. Let's quit at that point. Okay. On to the next question.
I remember having read a long time ago that a book, I can't remember exactly what it was, when I was doing a report for school, that there were earlier manuscripts or early manuscripts that were similar to the Adam and Eve story found in, I believe it was Egypt, but not completely the same or not completely identical with the Adam and Eve account. I was wondering if you could maybe comment on those. And also, I know a lot of people, Catholics especially, I'm kind of confused in recent days that if I recall correctly, the Pope made some statements regarding evolution, kind of recanting the Catholic Church's earlier stance on it, and I wonder if you could comment on both of those.
Okay, I may need a reminder on what the second one is by the time we get there. I've read a fair number of creation accounts that come to us from antiquity, and I don't recall offhand anyone in Egypt that closely resembles the Genesis account. Almost anywhere where you've got a creation account, they're going to say something about where humans came from. So you're going to have some kind of parallels in that particular direction. The Babylonian creation account, that Enuma Elish, I guess it is, has humans made out of clay. They're made at the end after Marduk shows himself to be the chief god because he's able to destroy Tiamat, the probably saltwater dragon or something of that sort. And they're made to serve the gods who have gotten tired of working or something of that sort. So you do have things of that sort in those accounts, and they may perfectly well be based on some kind of tradition that had come down through the human race that humans were created. I don't know whether they were or not. But they differ enough from the biblical account. I have not run into any guys in Old Testament studies that thought the Genesis account came from Egypt or something of that sort. There are a number of them that are inclined to think that with some good warrant, that the flood account from Babylonia is related to the flood account in Genesis. And my suggestion is that's probably because they're both really are memories of what happened. The Genesis account actually is rather more realistic in many ways than the other one is. The shape of the ark to be stable, sending out the bird that can handle a rougher environment first, and then the bird that can't handle a rougher environment second. Whereas you've got a different sort of picture in the Gilgamesh epic, the Babylonian flood account. So I can't say too much about that. Yes, there are creation accounts in most cultures, and they differ rather drastically in lots of ways. But typically, they're trying to tell you where everything came from, and one of the everythings that humans are typically interested in is humans, where humans came from. So we're going to get something in that particular model. Now I've forgotten the second question already.
It was regarding the Pope and
the Pope and yeah. I think I've read the statement. Okay. And if I'm right about that, I certainly have read a papal statement about evolution. One, it was badly handled in the media. Why? Because the Catholics have allowed for some kind of evolution since the 20s or 30s. They have allowed something of that sort, so it had not changed on that. In fact, the statement by the Pope was warning about making Adam purely a development by natural processes from the lower animals without some kind of an idea that God inserted a soul in them or something of that sort. So it's warning them not to go cross over that line. Well, of course, the complication is lots of Catholic scientists and theologians have long ago crossed over that line. So that raises the stink. But at least as the couple of media reports that I read garbled the account rather badly. That's not uncommon. A fair fraction of science reports that you see in your local newspapers, you really need to go look at the article and see what it's really about, because you often can't tell from the science article.
It says, of course, when people started to live less in the, like Pelagon lived a couple hundred years, there was a big change about that time, and of course it says the earth was divided in that time. And I wonder what you think about that, and whether, cosmic rays, were more cosmic rays coming in. I had thoughts that possibly the Earth was more compact and then expanded so that the continents drifted apart, mm-hmm. the radius of the Earth increased, more cosmic rays came in, people aged quicker. Is that some possibility from the Earth's cooling that it could expand and divide in some way like that?
I have seen diagrams now and again that seem to suggest that there are some guys out there in science who have suggested that the Earth was once smaller and has expanded or something of that sort. I'm not aware of any mechanism that would do that, so I'm pretty skeptical of that. And my impression is that at least the mass of geologists do not go in that direction, that the fact that we've got this separation between ocean basin and continents has something to do with the continents gradually being formed and then moving around, and of course the continental material can get lost down under. It's subduction and such when plates run together. The So I'm skeptical of that. The common treatment in younger circles for the aging that people don't live as long is that there was a water canopy around the Earth that protected the Earth from cosmic rays or something of that sort. I'm not sure they knew about them when the proposal was first made. It's at least centuries too old. And that falls down at the flood, and so then you begin to get a decreasing lifespan at that time. That's a possibility with several rather strong caveats. A younger fellow by the name of Jody Dillo has done rather elaborate work on the canopy theory called The Waters Above. I forgot who the publisher is, Baker or somebody. And he points out that for every 30 feet of water you put up there, you increase the atmospheric pressure down here by one atmosphere. So you can't get much water up there without having a very drastically different situation down here on the Earth. So he doesn't put much up there. So he tries to move most of it to the fountains and deep breaking up instead of the water coming down. My problem has largely been an exegetical problem, and that is the canopy theory is based upon the remark in Genesis 1 about the waters that are above the heavens, etc. But there's an almost identical phrase in Psalm 148 that suggests that whatever it was, it's still there at David's time. It's not something that disappeared at the flood. And so I did my STM thesis in Old Testament on the biblical teaching on the firmament, so I got into that sort of stuff. And doing a little study of how Hebrew prepositions handle what we would call non-solid objects, it came to me that for instance, the Hebrew says, and the leaves are carried before the wind, in front of the wind. And surely the Hebrews knew that there was wind out in front of the leaves, and that there was wind blowing past the leaves and things of that sort. So they were basically just saying, that's a way of saying in Hebrew, that the wind was moving leaves along. And when it talks about the clouds beneath the water, and the clouds are not ripped under the water, etc., that they're talking about the clouds holding the water in them up in some way. So what occurred to me then is that the waters above the heavens or above the firmament is talking about water that is held up by our atmosphere. Well, what kind of water is that? Well, one kind of water that is cloud water, atmospheric vapor or atmospheric droplets or things of that sort. So I think the passage in Genesis 1 is about clouds, and David then in Psalm 148 is talking about clouds. And so the canopy, I think, evaporates. Bad part, but goes away, I'm thinking anyway. Well, then you're still left with the question, why does the longevity go down? I don't know. What does control our longevity? Don't know for sure. At least the cosmic ray thing has this advantage, that we do think that accumulating mutations that the cells are unable to repair does have something to do with aging. But of course, a cosmic rays are by no means the only way to get things pressed up in that direction. Pollution can do that. Various other things may even be able to get some viruses to mess things up in that particular way as well. So God does something to run the longevity down rather substantially from the numbers you're getting. Notice they're already down a fair bit, though, by Noah's time. And then they continue on down and down and down. So that even by Moses' time, according to Psalm 90, his age is beyond what is expected considerably. That 70 or 80 is considered a kind of a standard lifespan at that time. And of course, that would still be considered a standard lifespan now, which we might be able to pick up 5 or 10 years on with some technology. The average is certainly still not range. They may have had in mind something beyond an average. A good life is 70 or 80 or something.
Really, what happened to the Earth? And I didn't get that too much. And then
the Peleg thing. Excuse me, I forgot about that. Some have taken that to be continents divide, etc. That's a possibility again because the Earth divided. But Earth is used another way in Scripture that we overlook again and again and again. It's used for the people of the Earth. The whole Earth rejoiced, or the did this or that sort of thing. It's easy to find biblical passages, though none of them come to my mind right away, that uses earth for the people. And if that's so, then it's referring to the Babel incident, surely, when the people scattered. And so it's saying, you want to peg when Babel was, it was an intelligent generation. And that's the way I've taken it, as not bringing in something from outside, and that being probably the context, the way of reading that. Okay, that's all I can say on that. So, okay, further questions?
What is your perception on the Mark of the Beast and the rapture in the chronological order?
Ah! Well, I'm a post-trib rapturist, so I think if I'm still alive, we'll still be here. I'll still be here when all that happens. But of course, I'll still be alive or not. What's the mark of the beast? I don't think it's a universal pricing code that happens to have some sixes in it, although that's been suggested. I don't think it's the name of some computer that the European community has got, although they had one named the Beast at one time. My guess is miniaturization has probably made that less beastly in size or something of that sort. 666 is thought by most interpreters to be an example of gematria, of taking the numerical values of a word in Greek and converting them into a number then. That seems a little strange to us because our number system uses a different set of symbols than our words do. We have a 26-letter alphabet in English, and then we have a 10-character number system that we borrowed from the Arabs, who borrowed it from the Hindus, etc. And so we don't tend to think of them that way. But the Hebrews and the Greeks both, and the Romans in a different way, use their regular letters, their alphabet, to make numbers. All of us somewhere along the line, maybe they don't teach it anymore now, but back when I was a kid, they taught you Roman numerals in school. Okay? So you knew that I was one, two I's were two, and three I's were three. And some clocks had four I's for four, but usually it was I, V, V for five, and all of that sort of thing. The Roman method of counting used just a few letters of the alphabet. I, V, X, L, L, C, D, M, and then did something funny after that. The Greek and the Hebrew methods, though, was to use all the letters of their alphabet. And Greeks, with a little finagling, could get a 27-letter alphabet. By New Testament times, they're down to 24, but there were some old letters. So they used alpha for 1, beta for 2, gamma for 3, delta for 4, epsilon for 5, etc. And then when they got up to 9... the next letter was 10, that's reasonable, but the next letter was 20, and the next was 30, and the next was 40, etc. And so that's what they did. The Hebrews did the same thing. I don't think that happens until late. There, I think they had some other method for doing numbers and really early stuff, but by the time we have Hebrew manuscripts, they're using a system like that. And the Hebrews have a shorter alphabet, so I think it quits at 400 or something, and then they use combinations above that to get the other hundreds. And the Greeks, at least, used a little mark on one side to show you as the number, and if they want to do thousands, they used a mark in another place with the letters to show you that. Well, what's that all about? What it means is that any word in Greek, you can replace each of the letters by a number and then add them up. And so gematria for that, if you assume it's 666, is presumed to mean then that if you take the name of the Antichrist and you add up the values of the letters, you get 666. Now, there are lots of ways to do that, so there's been lots of speculation over history of what it might be. But somebody noticed, I don't know when they noticed it, I first ran into it in a end-of-the-age novel written back in the 1890s or something of that sort by a guy named Watson, that the simplest way of 666 is to find the Hebrew letter for 600, the Greek letter for 600, the Greek letter for 60, and the Greek letter for 6. Well, if you do that, the 600 letter is chi, what the fraternity guys call chi, okay? And the 60 letter is xi, which is, fraternity stuff, caps is two of these and a little one of these in the middle. Then the sixth one throws your curve, because the Greeks used a letter they weren't using anymore. And that letter was written a couple of different ways. One pronunciation was a vav, and it was a V sound, and another form of it was digamma, when it actually looked kind of like an F. And Sometimes you see it also written as a, what looks like a final sigma, a what's called a stigma that has a sort of a S shape. And if you take it as the stigma, then what you actually get is you get three letters, ki, xi, stigma. And ki and stigma would work very well as a monogram for Christ, very much like the ki sigma that was used as a monogram for Christ, but it's got a snake in the middle of it. So I think probably what John is telling us with the 666 is this is the snake's Christ. This is the serpent's Christ. Which is saying what? It's the Antichrist. Which, by the way, that word does not occur anywhere in Revelation. So, the book of Revelation otherwise uses the beast. Who's it going to be? We'll wait and see. Wait and see. I'm skeptical about the popular one some years ago that was Kissinger, which we've gotten by assuming that the letters of the English would be used. And when you got to 10, the next letter was 11, the next letter was 12, the next letter was 13, and then when you add them all up for Kissinger, you get 111, and you multiply by 6, and you get 666. I thought there were too many funny maneuvers in the thing to make that likely. So we'll wait and see. It's, of course, conceivable that the guy's name or his or a nickname or something with him might also add up that way. But the way in which at least the original reader could understand it, I think, would be that the Ki Sigma type symbol was already being used as an abbreviation for Christos, and the Xi, as it's typically written, it looks very much like a snake. So, okay, further questions? We've run out of steam here. I'm doing okay, so if you've got questions, I'll keep trying.
I come at this from the standpoint of a non-Christian who's trying to understand and trying to understand how to believe. And so I, at one point, I asked you this when we met, I think, a day or so ago. I was trying to think of things that would make me believe from my own experience. And one of those would be Carl Sagan's example of seeing something like a message in something that was already existent. And so I'm asking this because I'm just trying to understand.
Uh-huh.
I don't mean to be confrontational. I was asking you what would make you not believe. And you gave two examples, one of which was if something in the Bible was not true. And so I guess I have several times tried to become a Christian by reading the Bible, and it doesn't seem to me that most of it is easy to interpret as being true. Now, of course, this is probably reflecting my own experience more than anything else.
Uh-huh.
But an example of a statement that bothered me was, this is Genesis 3:14. So the Lord said to the serpent, because you've done this, cursed are you above all livestock and all wild animals. You'll crawl on your belly and you will eat dust all the days of your life.
Uh-huh.
Now this strikes me as it's saying that snakes will eat dirt. And we know this isn't true. Snakes are predators. You know, they hunt other animals.
Uh-huh.
And so it's hard for me to reconcile a statement like that as being true. And so I guess my question would be, how would you understand a statement like that, or if there's any other examples from the Bible you'd like to cite that may not seem to be true at first? I'd like to understand how you would see that as being true.
Okay. One, it's probably an idiom. Probably an idiom. Okay. We even in English have, you pull up to a guy beside the, you know, you're both at the stoplight, you pull up to the other guy and you say, eat my dust, fella. Leave them in the dust or something of that sort. So here, however, looking a little bit at Hebrew background anyway, probably suggesting being humiliated is the idea. Very common in the Middle East. In fact, one of the standard practices of a conqueror was to bring in the generals that he conquered, and they'd have him lay down there and he puts his foot on their neck. You see that mentioned once or twice in the Old Testament where Joshua has his men come in and do that with some kings they'd conquered. But you see that pictorially on a number of the panels from the Assyrians and such. So, some kind of a positional way of viewing humiliation. That I think is what's going on there. Now, it may be that God is there playing on a feature about the snake. There are lots of Christians out there that believe that snakes had legs up until that time and lost them. I don't think there's any warrant for that, but it's been suggested. I think the picture basically is that Satan, having chosen to use a snake for his dirty business, he's going to wind up being like a snake. He's going to wind up biting the dust, we might say. That's moving to an idiom that sounds similar but has a little different meaning in English. So that's what I would see going on in a passage like that. You are going to be humiliated, and that's developed in the passage. The seed of woman, some descendant of Eve, is going to crush your head, but you are going to bite his heel. And you see, you're still using the snake connection there. You're going to injure him somehow, but he is going to wipe you out, sort of thing. And we understand as Christians that that's one of the first hints that God is going to send the Messiah, the descendant of woman, and he is going to defeat Satan, etc. So that's the way I would deal in that particular passage.
Okay, so might a generalization of that be that I shouldn't try to understand statements in the Bible quite literally the first time I read them, that I need to study it more, basically?
Well, that's certainly a possibility. Martin Luther's procedure, he was certainly, you know, by the time he mentions those things at his table talk or something, you know, he studied Hebrew and he studied Greek and things like that, so he said, when I come to a passage I don't understand in the Bible, I take my hat off and pass it by, etc. And what he was doing is he was saying, I believe God wrote this, and so I wouldn't be surprised and I might not understand all of it, but I'm going to try, but I'm not going to jump to conclusions, etc. If you stop and think about it, I'm not big on reader response criticism and such, if you like, but there really is something to be said for, you know, if you pick up a sheet of paper and it's got some stuff scribbled on it, and you thought that that a kid in the first grade scribbled on it, you thought that Einstein scribbled on it, you know, trying to figure out what this is about. Or if you looked at some drawing on the wall and you thought that some chimp did it, yeah, I'm not bad for a chimp. But if you thought that one of your major artists did the thing, one of your drip painters or somebody like that, you might say, there must be something to that, etc. So what are you doing there? You're changing your expectations based on your understanding of who the author might be. Obviously, there are lots of writings that have been put out at various times by various people that claim to be communications from God. So there's some sense in which we've got to test things to see whether we can satisfy ourselves that's really the case, that they really are from a particular one, it really is from God. But certainly there's some warrant on giving the author the benefit of the doubt in things. So that's the kind of thing I would do. There are lots of passages I didn't understand 20 years ago that I understand now, I think. So there is some progress as you work through things.
If I may take up just a
go ahead, more, go ahead.
One,
no, that's
one,
what
one more follow-up on question on that, because I have friends on both sides who are very Christian,
sure,
and
good,
very non-Christian.
Okay.
And from the non-Christian side, the counter to something like that, like having to work to understand every passage in the Bible, I think what the response would be, you'd probably never accept anything in the Bible being untrue, that you would try to find an interpretation which would make it true. And so in some sense, you're not allowing anything to be true. You're not allowing anything in the Bible to be false.
Uh-huh.
What would your response to something like that be? Is that a valid criticism or way of thought, or is there something that we are missing by a sort of accusing
good question.
A believer of saying that?
Yeah. I think the believer, as believer, says, well, I believe this from God, so I'm going to try and understand it in a way that makes sense. Though I'll sometimes come up with, I'm not sure how to understand it. Okay, I see this problem, and I'm not sure how to see a solution, etc. But you can certainly imagine situations in which the person says, that's enough. Okay, I've had too many of those. I'm not going to deceive myself any longer, or something. Christians, I think, can imagine themselves doing that occasionally and aren't so much worried about the consequences if they do that and they're right. They're worried about the consequences if they do that and they're wrong. Right? That you walked away from something that's super crucial because you have not understanding something or been or looked at it with the wrong spin on it. You have mishandled the thing. So certainly Christians would have some concern about that. We believe that the consequences are very substantial, but we do believe that God expects us to do our best to make true judgments. And so we're going to try and judge things fairly. So I would basically say, in my own case, that I'm satisfied with the evidence from nature, from science, and the evidence from the biblical material in regard to fulfilled prophecy, changed lives, explanation of how things fit together, picture of human nature that seems to me to be very true to life, etc., that this really is from God. And so there'll be places where I don't understand what's going on there, but I'll let it ride. None of us in our actual worldviews have every question answered. And some questions put tension on whether our worldview is right, and some other questions only put tension on whether we've understood something or another, and you know, that's less crucial sort of thing. If you read Kuhn's Nature, Structure, Scientific Revolutions, you see some of the same phenomena going on, that a person who are convinced of a particular paradigm will attempt to fit in what appear to be recalcitrant data. And if their paradigm is really good, that stuff will eventually fit. If it's not really good, it's quite possible that stuff will eventually override their paradigm and some other paradigm. But notice that very remark, some other paradigm. You then have to back up and say, okay, what are the paradigms we got? Well, in principle, we've got an infinite number of them. You don't know an infinite number of them. So the competitors would be something like secular humanism. And I'd say, what? That doesn't have a good explanation of the universe, doesn't have a good explanation of life. It reduces humans to something that I don't think they can even get to work. That they're all some kind of automatons or something. They really don't explain consciousness. They really don't explain love. They really don't explain morality. You know, there's a whole class of things that seem to me that that some kind of a theistic worldview explains better. So that's kind of what we do. To a certain extent, anytime you're judging a theory, you're judging theory vis-a-vis alternative theories. That's been one of the complaints of evolutionists is, okay, you guys are dumping on evolution all the time. What do you got to put in place of it? Well, frankly, I think people who believe in intelligent design have got something to put in place of it, though not having the billions of dollars that that governments have been spending on biological research. There are lots of loose ends, but a suggestion that somehow we are having intelligence doing something to what we see to be able to make the structures and how it's doing it and that sort of thing. Very quick tour through epistemology a little bit. But
I was wondering what the young Earth creationist responses are to things such as geological evidence like seafloor spreading and some of the dating techniques that have been used by scientists. I know that in with regard to the dating techniques that there's been attempts to call them into question as being possibly spurious. And I was wondering what your response to that would be.
Yeah. I have a two-page sheet here stuck in front. This is from a debate I did some time ago on some simple problems for young Earth creationism. And how they handled seafloor spreading is they claim that it was very fast right after the flood and it slowed down to the current value. The way some of them explain light travel time is that the speed of light was very fast at creation and it slowed down. The way they explain the cooling of certain rock that we can see was molten at one time is that it cooled down very fast and has now slowed down, etc. You see what's going on? They're extrapolating specific changed rates outside of where we've got any specific evidence, whereas old Earth creationists, along with, I will admit, theistic evolutionists and evolutionists and et cetera, are suggesting, well, if we use the values that are currently existing, we in fact get an old Earth. We in fact get the kind of dates you're suggesting there. And what I'm suggesting is that that doesn't necessarily indicate some unbelieving attitude or some rejection of the supernatural. It's just basically saying, it looks to me like the fact that this rock was once molten and it's such a big blob that in simple calculations it would have taken way over 10,000 years to cool, would have taken some millions of years to cool for something this big, is in fact a marker that indicates that that's how old it is. And notice it fits in with the light travel time thing again and such. So that's the kind of direction I go. But they do a lot of that. One guy denies that there's been any change in the direction of the magnetic field. that fall decaying because he works out a nice theory for how the Earth can't be over 20,000 years old if the Earth, if the magnetic fields have been decaying. But geological stuff shows that magnetic field is oscillating in some way. And another guy basically has all the oscillations in the 1 year of the flood, because they're in the strata. So you've got no oscillations back here, you've got 1,000 oscillations in 1 year here, and then you've got no oscillations after there. Funny business again, it seems to me. So, again, I come back to, that stuff was laid down over a long period of time and such. So, yeah. There are a set of tapes available from IBRI of a debate, between myself and an associate from IBRI and Dwayne Gish, an associate from Institute of Creation Research on the 8th Earth. That was about a 3-day, weekend seminar up in the Poconos some years ago. And, we distribute the tapes and they don't. So, we have doctored them, by the way.
I have two questions, I guess, for you. One of which is fairly minor, but it's of minor trouble to me. In your book, Genesis 1 and the Age of the Earth, you suggest that the creation days are 24-hour days, but they're open creative periods.
Okay, yeah.
And that we have not yet entered into the seventh day,
okay,
which I like in many ways, of course, because Christ said that his Father was still about his work and all of these things. But then if you go look in Hebrews chapter 4, it says, and on the seventh day God rested from all his work. And then on another verse it says, for anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his, speaking past tense. And again, in the debate with Gish, I've read the transcript of a debate between Gish and Hugh Ross, and Gish kept taking him to task because he said, your view has universes, or has stars still being created and so forth, but we know that God has rested from his creative works. So I guess I'm just asking here, it seems like there are different verses in the Bible about whether or not God is working and so forth and how you define creative works. So how would you respond to those verses in Hebrews with your view that we haven't yet entered the seventh day?
Okay. Well, what I'd do is I'd say, let's look at how the Greek translates Hebrew verbs. And what you find out quite standardly is that the Greek Septuagint, the translation of the Old Testament in the Greek about 200 to about 250 to about 150 B.C., is they typically use an aorist tense to translate the Hebrew perfect, which the Hebrew perfect is a tense that indicates an action viewed as complete. It doesn't tell you whether it was complete in the past, complete in the present, or complete in the future. And then the Hebrew imperfect shows an action looked at as in process, but it doesn't tell you whether it's in process in the past, or in process in the present, or in process in the future. That is, the Hebrew verb system is structured in terms of the character of the action, not the time of the action. That comes from other information. But the Greeks translated, and they typically translated the imperfect by future tense and the perfect by an aorist tense. Now, that's what the writer of Hebrews does in the book of Hebrews. When he quotes the Old Testament, he will use a aorist tense there. Is he saying by that, by translating it by that tense, I am telling you it's already taken place, or I'm just using the standard way of translating that particular verb, and you've got to find out from the other passages where that's taking place. And that's the direction I go in that particular matter. You get into lots of problems like that with translation that I know no solution to. You've got six guys sitting around a table who are the editorial committee for a new translation. They've got to vote and make a decision on what word they're going to translate something by. And two of them may feel you need to translate this way, and two of them may feel you have to translate that way, and two of them feel this way. They've got to make some compromise and come up with some solution. They may put something in a footnote, or they may not. And sometimes you're very aggravated with how they did that. In my talk tomorrow morning, I have one little place where I'm aggravated on how the NIV translators handled one word in Isaiah that I'll mention then. But that happens, and that's all I can do with the passage. I do not climb out on a huge limb that my particular view there is right, that the seventh day hasn't occurred yet. A probably more common view among younger, older creationists is that the days are ages, and that the seventh day has started already, but it isn't over yet. Okay, and basically, I did not like how that meshed with the John 5 passage, my Father is working up until now, and so am I. They're jumping on Jesus for violating the Sabbath, as they think. And I think what he's saying is, my Father is still at work in doing the very things that the Sabbath rest marks the completion of, that